content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we left off last time in the chapter Death and Afterlife, which is for November and December in the garden. And our topic for today is cultivating snags or wildlife trees. Snag, not as in my pantyhose, which I haven't worn since departing the corporate world in 2007 for an existence where fashion has zero status. Snag as in wildlife tree, a place to nest or den, a source of food for insects, which are in turn food for many other creatures, a perch for lookout, and more. If a tree on your property is dying or dead, or if a healthy tree must be lowered for safety or other reasons, you have the opportunity to cultivate a snag. In 2014, I had to finally reckon with a 40-foot-tall twin-trunk birch that was in decline, dropping massive portions of its crown on two small outbuildings. To the arborist's surprise, I didn't let them take it all down or even cart away most of what had to be cut, but rather simply let the carcass lie beside the remaining trunk to rot. And here's why. Biomass. Removing all that living or recently living mass of organic material would be a big loss, biologically speaking, for the complex organism I call my garden. The National Wildlife Federation estimates that the removal of dead material from forests can mean a loss of habitat for up to one-fifth of the animals in the ecosystem. Some experts recommend an ideal snag population to be about 3 dead standing trees per acre. That's how important they are. Never remove any more of the of a dying or damaged tree than is required for safety reasons. Even a high stump can support a lot of wildlife action compared to a clean cut at ground level, or worse, a ground out stump. Lowering the larger cut down limbs and trunk portions to the ground and allowing them to rot there as if they had fallen naturally is also better ecologically than carting them away. Make like the tree fell besides where it once grew, even if logistics require you to do it in big pieces rather than whole. Who will thank you? Cavity nesters from pileated woodpeckers who can actually excavate to secondary cavity nesters such as flying squirrels, wood ducks, and even bluebirds. Any creature that is at least partly insectivorous, since insects and other small invertebrates will show up to feast on the tree's carcass. Birds such as hawks and owls, who want a good vantage point to survey the area for prey. Animals, as small as salamanders and snakes, or as large as bears, who may enjoy the hiding place a fallen tree provides. My most beloved birds, the shy little brown creeper, will nest beneath loose bark, for instance, and other animals cache wood stuffs for later use there too. The list is long. Years ago, when one trunk of a multi-stemmed century-old apple tree here lost its crown in a storm, I simply stabilized that snapped-off trunk by taking off anything that was hanging and left it otherwise intact. I've spent more than 15 years since watching who shows up to enjoy it along with me and the distinctive evolving character of the elderly tree. My newest snag, the birch, isn't perfect. Ideally, there would have been some lower branches to leave intact to make it a more attractive destination to wildlife. But the giant twin trunks were already naked until past 20 feet, where the die-off had set in. I could have had the arborist create jagged tops to each trunk to make it more naturalistic and also speed decay if the tree had not already had plenty of cavities. We could have started some, but it was already a condo complex. And this, I should have cut the trunks down even lower, because they could still potentially fall on one shed. I think that's unlikely for many more years, though, so I was happy with the risk-reward ratio in leaving the snag as big as could be. I expect the birch to host a lot of happy visitors between now and then. Winterizing the water garden. In more than 25 years of operating two homemade in-ground water gardens, I have probably broken lots of rules, especially about winterizing. But there are some rules I never veer from, and keeping the surface from freezing over is the most important. If trapped under solid ice, decomposing plant material and wastes from fish or other inhabitants contribute to a buildup of noxious elements such as ammonia, nitrites, and carbon dioxide, harming or suffocating any overwintering occupants and also tainting the water. Make a plan now to keep a hole in the ice. All winter long, birds and active animals thank me for supplying water as a side effect of my de-icing scheme. Depending on surface area, water volume, and wintertime temperature lows, maintain at least a small opening with an appropriate wattage level of floating pond de-icer. Water garden suppliers can help you calculate the correct one. Water gardeners in fairer climates may keep a hole open with a bubbler or aerator operated by a pump and submerged maybe 6 inches, positioned near the edge of the pool. That doesn't work here. Because of coming winter lows, I turn off my pumps around Thanksgiving, meaning the spillways and biological filters are no longer operational. I don't pull my pumps, though experts recommend it, But what turning off the water does is protect tubing. Much of it is exterior to the pool, hidden behind stonework from freezing, then perhaps rupturing during thaws. I do lift empty and clean external filters because they too would freeze and crack. I don't drain my pools any time, but work all season to maintain a healthy water condition. Going on that an ounce of prevention theory, plenty of submerged oxygenator plants help in the warm months, as do dainty little true floaters such as azolla or fairy moss and lemna or duckweed. In fall, I trim any plants that are up and over the edge and thin whatever somewhat if the pool seems congested. Non-hardy plants must be removed before frost and stored or discarded. But note, never put any aquatic plant into natural waterways. They are only for use in lined water gardens and pots, and not even there in certain states that forbid their sale. Using a net or skimmer, I also remove leaves that blow in. I don't strive for the bottoms of the pools to be muck-free, however. My amphibian friends love a nice cushion of glop down there to sleep on or in. Though my in-ground pools are just 1,800 and 800 gallons, four frog and toad species and two salamander species reproduce in them year after year, as do many impressive beneficial insects. Amazing and a wonder I never tire of celebrating. If you have seasonal water gardens in pots, empty and store them if the container's not waterproof. But you probably already figured that part out. A final thought, got fish? Stop feeding. Once the pond water is below about 50 degrees, I don't feed my comets, very hardy goldfish-like creatures, who have lived for many years in one pool. Fish do fine without supplemental food pellets until spring. Mine actually told me around October, when they are done eating, if I toss pellets into the pool, they'd show disinterest once it was cold. And our next topic is winterberry hollies. The birds and I have much in common. We stand on two legs, are lightweight, flit nonstop from one thing to another, and can't get enough winterberry hollies. That species is native from Canada south to Florida, from Wisconsin and Missouri east, often seen in moist spots, though apparently quite adaptable. In southern areas from Virginia to Texas, Ilex decidua is the native deciduous holly. Despite their heritage in wetlands, I grow my plants in normal soil on my windy hillside. Though they will fruit more heavily in a moist year than a dry one, winter berries never disappoint. These are durable shrubs best used in sunny mass plantings. you need a male plant, non-fruiting, per 6 or 8 females, and their bloom times must coincide. So specific males pollinate specific females. The garden center can help with the matchmaking, though some names are real tip-offs, like Red Butler to Scarlet O'Hara. Don't line the front walk with winter berries, or otherwise make them 365-day focal points, where their nondescript spring and summer appearance, twiggy with plain green leaves, would be a letdown. Sight them instead, massed as a long view item for fall and winter, when the garden is otherwise pretty quiet. I have groups of 8 to 12 plants positioned in 4 directions from key indoor vantage points, and even at 60 and 100 feet away, the fruited groupings read as brilliant landscape elements, some would say holiday decorations, when I am tucked indoors. There are many cultivars, and though most stand around 6 or 8 feet when fully grown, I have Sparkleberry at more like 10 and Nana, usually called Red Sprite, at 3-ish. Fruit colors are often red or orange-red, but may also be orange gold, the winter gold and Orantiaca, and even yellow, goldfinch, also compact. Fruit size varies too, as does how profuse it is and how long it holds on the plant, not counting bird interventions. Since I crave gold-leafed plants, when I learned that both winterberry and gold foliage came in one package, there was probably no chance I'd escape heading to the cash register without at least one Ilex verticillata, or sunsplash, in my cart, a Broken Arrow nursery introduction of a female clone with orange-red fruit and gold variegated leaves. Only one problem. The birds know me by now and get a little greedy. Normally, they start eating in late October after the winterberry leaves drop, and a mixed flock of cedar waxwings and robins attack one or two plantings and then move on, or not. If they are out in forceful numbers and stay a couple of days, I'll be fruitless. One tip. Normally, birds start with red fruits and don't eat the paler orange and golden ones till much later. So to hopefully extend your visual enjoyment, include some non-red ones. The years when it's all gone so early, I worry about both of us. Maybe the birds have discovered another trove of winter food nearby and staked it out for later sustenance. I hope so, but I have no personal backup plan, although some long outdoor extension cords and several dozen strings of those tiny twinkly Christmas lights, not in white, but red, might do the trick. And our next heading is Willing Houseplants. The ultimate 365-day plants are the ones we label houseplants, a term that wants to diminish their actual versatility. In fact, my collection of houseplants, some of which, like several very big pots of Clevia minata, have been with me for more than 40 years, are happy to keep company together indoors when the weather forbids anything more daring, and then just as capably relocate and dress up semi-shady spots in the garden through the frost-free months. Workhorse houseplants reduce the need to buy anywhere near the number of tender annuals each spring to stage lavish vignettes of pots leading up to the house in areas of bright shade beneath trees as a sort of welcome to the garden message. Because I use more indoor-outdoor foliage stars than bedding flowers, the effect hints at what you'll see elsewhere around the place. 2. Good foliage first and foremost in color, texture, and scale. I have the random oddballs that stay inside year-round to stave off loneliness, Pilia peperomioides, the Chinese money plant, and the biggest clevia. Far odder still are a couple of very old plants with caudices, singular caudex, a specialized swollen base, and water storage organ. The bombax and climbing onion stay put as well. Everyone else goes out. When I say everyone else, mostly I bank on fancy leaf begonias, the clevias, and an odd assortment of bromeliads for years of year-round trusted service. The clevias, divisions of family hand-me-downs, are easy provided they're given well-drained potting soil, bright light but not direct sun, and most of all are rested below 50 degrees, but above 35 degrees Fahrenheit. For about 40 days, starting late fall, I don't water while they literally chill out. The idea is that about 2 months after you raise the temperature to over 60 degrees Fahrenheit, ending their rest, flower spikes will start to form for bloom in March or April. Without the cold period, they would probably bloom in June or even summer, and the flower stalk may not elongate fully, so the orange or yellow blooms will be hidden. With their shrubby scale, they make a big statement, indoors or out, in bloom or not, and no doubt will outlive me as they did my forebears. I can't really claim to make the bromeliads ideally happy without more indoor humidity in winter. I find that I can get about 5 years from them anyhow by offering regular showers in the bathtub as an imperfect substitute, and diligently keeping the cups of each rosette of leaves filled with water. It seems worth the investment to have their sculptural, multicolored foliage and the occasional tropical bloom in the mix in my staged pot groupings, even if they are not forever friends. If you select the right begonias, they will be around a long time. I just call them all fancy leaf begonias, but they divide into several structural groups. I do best with some of the fibrous-rooted cane types, like hybrid Little Brother Montgomery, which can achieve shrubby proportion, and most of all, rhizomatous ones. Skipping the extra flashy Rex ones among those which don't seem to like me. Reliable Rhizomatous Marmaduke, Autumn Ember, Kit Kat, Palomar Prince, and Black Fancy are among the many I recommend. By midwinter, the begonias are not thrilled with our shared digs and looking worse for wear. Supplemental fluorescent lighting and perhaps a humidifier would make them happier, but we've managed well enough for years. They dislike low humidity, especially when it's warm, indoors or out. They dislike cold. I try not to subject them to anything below about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, but my brightest winter spots are in the too cool for comfort mudroom. Like virtually every houseplant, they hate wet feet or soggy soil. So avoid watering before dry and don't let them stand in saucers of water. In winter, I barely water once a week. Feed weekly in periods of active growth and not at all from about October to February. I think the fancy leaf begonias spend winter dreaming of their escape to the outdoors, months of high humidity, where they grow happily in the filtered light under trees. I remind them that such better days are just ahead when they're sulking and starting to look pretty sparse. Blessedly, unlike a bromeliad you push too far, many of the best begonias resurrect miraculously when they are set free to serve in the garden once again. And we have come to the end of this program, so we'll continue with conifers on the next podcast. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.